In the printed lesson material, an outline has already been given of the background and general circumstances of the writing of this beautiful little letter, so that nothing more need be said about that, beyond the fact that it is a letter of introduction from Paul to Philemon on behalf of a runaway slave called Onesimus, who was probably the bearer of it. Nothing throws more light on the life and ways of a people than reading their intimate, day-to-day correspondence, if samples of such can be found. Here, in such correspondence, they unconsciously reveal themselves, their manners, their attitudes, their scales of values, their joys and sorrows, their aspirations, and so on. In their letters, we can, in fact, see the kind of people they were. Nothing is more important for us than to know what kind of people the early Christians were, how they lived and thought and acted toward each other and toward God and toward the people all around them. We know, of course, what they believed, for we have this in the New Testament, that is, a record of their beliefs. But what a person says he believes and how he actually lives can, unfortunately, be far apart. In short, if we are to follow the biblical pattern, we must not only believe what they believed, but we must live as they lived, be the kind of people they were, since Christianity is a way of life rather than a body of doctrine. It is a great pity that we have not done more reading of the New Testament with this aim before us, and there is no writing more revealing than the letter you are now about to study, that is, Paul's letter to Philemon. First, of course, there is the basic fact that the early Christians did write to each other, and we could learn something from them in this. A careful reading of the New Testament books and letters will reveal that a constant, warm flow of communication was kept moving back and forth between these affectionate people, who cared for each other in every phase of their common lives and just wanted to keep in touch. Paul, in this letter, for example, speaks of having heard how the hearts of the believers were refreshed through their contact with Philemon. We know when he wrote to the Corinthians that he told them things he had heard from the Christians. John, in writing his second and third letters, refers to information which he had received from the brethren and from his children. And in many other ways we know of this constant stream of contact and communication that flowed back and forth between these early Christians. We could learn something from them even in this matter. A few sheets of paper carried around with us and used in the odd moments of waiting would open up a whole new segment of helpful Christian fellowship and communion. We could also learn much from the exquisite good taste and courtesy and tact and graciousness of this little gem of a letter which Paul wrote to Philemon. The pagan society around us seems to think that friendship and intimacy are best expressed or shown in a boisterous and rough backslapping kind of pose. Even Christians have fallen into these patterns, thinking that there is some merit in treating each other with the manners of the football dressing room or with the vocabulary of Cassius Clay. Christian love and togetherness are not seen at their best in uncouth crudities. The gentleness of Christ will be the hallmark of everyone who bears his name and copies his way of life. And courtesy is a beautiful thing. One remembers having seen up in a trucking center once one of those wayside signs which said, "Courtesy is like an air cushion. There's not much in it, but it eases the jolts wonderfully, and we could practice a good deal more of it if we only stopped to think." Notice also the fact that the greatest and busiest of all the apostles, while in prison, harried daily by what he refers to as the care of all the churches, and faced with decisions that could affect the whole afterlife of the church, would yet take time to interest himself so far in the affairs of Onesimus as to write a personal letter on his behalf. Onesimus was probably an illiterate foreigner, picked up somewhere on the outskirts of the Roman wars, and sold naked in a public market like a sheep or a goat, to do the most menial chores for his master. On top of this, he had proved himself unreliable and unprofitable. And even if now a Christian, he was from a different world from that of Paul, the intellectual Roman citizen and patrician, the friend of doctors and scholars, ex-member of the Sanhedrin and trusted emissary of the high priest, able to stand unflattered and unflattering before governors, princes, kings, and even the emperor. And yet, this same aristocratic intellectual Paul did, in fact, write a letter for this young man, and he wrote it lovingly, even passionately, calling him in Colossians 4, verse 9, a faithful and beloved brother, and here referring to him as my very heart, verse 12, and asking Philemon to treat him as he would have treated Paul himself, verse 17. Surely we can learn much from this unconsciously revealed Christian humility, love, unselfishness, concern, and interest, for Paul never so much as lets drop a word to call attention to what he is doing in the thing at all. Note also his ready and generous linking of a much younger and less famous man as his co-worker, that is, Timothy. Not only his co-worker, but his joint sender of the letter, Paul and brother Timothy. The names go together in the address. Unnecessary, quite unnecessary, yet done nevertheless. We cannot miss the tenderness of the greeting in this letter. These men loved each other, and they were neither afraid nor embarrassed to say so. Perhaps we could learn something from this. Christians should love each other, and undoubtedly do, but in this present age of ours, somehow or other, we have been conditioned, brainwashed into thinking that it's somehow not quite right to express Christian love for each other. Not only did they love each other, but they prayed for each other, verse 4. And they followed each other's spiritual development and activity, verses 5 and 7. They were careful to act according to the very highest code of ethics, and with great care for the rights of others, verses 14 and 18. There was no thought of acting less than properly, just because all involved were Christian friends. Everything must be handled on the very highest level and in a spirit of Christian consideration for one another. The same high standard of ethics in very ordinary matters is seen in the fact that Paul insists on Onesimus's going back to his master to put right everything outstanding between them. The fact that Onesimus had become a Christian and known forgiveness from God for his past did not release him from his obligations under the laws of the society in which he lived. Restitution must be made. His master must be satisfied before the law. His own standing must be cleared up. And so back Onesimus must go, and this little letter is proof that he actually did go back. This raises the whole subject of slavery, of course, and this letter gives the New Testament answer. Far from being a political revolutionary, the Christian is under orders from God, Romans 13, to be subject to those who rule. Servants, even slaves, were to be obedient to their masters. We have this very clearly in the closing of both Ephesians and Colossians. This was the law of the land at that time. Christians, moreover, were never campaigners to force on non-Christians obedience to the Christian code of ethics. Their aim is very far different. They will follow the teachings of Christ themselves, and such teachings will lead them personally into an understanding of Christian family relationships which will make slavery an impossible and incongruous violence. The Christian will also bring others to Christ, and then he will instruct these others in Christ's teachings. But he will not militantly press for the practice of Christian morality by people who neither have the spiritual life nor the spiritual power to live such a life. And he knows anyhow that historically, and as a matter of plain fact, all such effects, that is to force Christian morality on an unconverted people, have failed and must fail.